The combination made my eyes bleed. No question. This sweet, sweet music just I'm telling you, it reminds me of pizza when I hear this song now. It just makes me hungry when I hear Wu-Tang, because this is invariably playing over at Boca, and we got the chef here, Bo Schooler. And Bo, thanks for coming in, man.
Yeah.
For Foodie Friday.
Is that what's going on?
This is called Foodie Friday.
Okay.
I don't know. Talk to Scott. It's his concept.
I will. We're going to have a conversation.
But we've had a great time bringing in people who we've had people who are cooks at home, and then we've had people like yourselves who are professional cooks, and they come in and share a recipe, or they talk about a food or something like that that has really inspired them.
Okay.
And then the idea is that maybe people will get inspired and they'll try cooking it at home, take a couple of pictures, talk about the experience, why their version of something didn't turn out or why it turned out great, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Scott especially, he's talked to me about this before. He's talked to me about your fried chicken, the life-changing fried chicken.
The life-changing fried chicken.
Which I remember at Rookery. I don't think you serve that at Boca that much, or do you?
We did for maybe a month, but my fryer broke, and I don't have the money to fix it. So,
that's running a small business,
yeah,
man.
Pretty much.
That's like,
well,
you gotta.
I can do without fried chicken for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me why you think this has had such a profound effect on people like Scott. What is it about this fried chicken that you think makes it different? What do you do to make a great fried chicken?
I mean, I got to know which fried chicken he's talking about, because we've done like three different kinds of fried chicken at Rookery.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your favorite, and what are some of the reasons why the ones that you do that you really feel like work out well, or what is it? What's kind of the – I guess I'm asking, what's the secret?
What's the secret?
Yeah, what's the secret to great fried chicken?
Brining.
Okay.
It's always brining. So we started with a wet brine. So when you brine things, the salt kind of keeps the protein strands from constricting when you're cooking them, which makes it so that you have kind of a more juicier chicken.
Okay. And does it do that just on the outer layers, or does it really penetrate the entire piece of chicken?
It penetrates in there.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we started with a wet brine where you're soaking it in water, and you can kind of flavor it. So you can put lemon or spices or herbs in there, and it kind of gets in the chicken. And then we switched to a dry brine, which kind of does the exact same thing.
And it's just using the juices of the chicken itself
creates its own brine.
Yeah.
And so when we're doing the southern fried chicken, like that kind of is your like buttermilk and dredge type of flour dredge thing, which like a real helpful thing there is just making sure you double dredge it. So like flour, buttermilk, and the flour again, so you get a strong crust.
And when you're saying buttermilk, like that's just in the crust. That's not – you're not soaking it in buttermilk overnight, or are you doing that too? Or?
It depends on what we're doing. Like we do fried chicken sandwiches at the Rookery, and we just soak them in buttermilk and then throw it right in the flour, because it's kind of a thin piece of meat. So if I did this double dredge, it'd be almost as much crust on the chicken than there is actual meat. So it kind of depends on what you're going for.
Yeah.
And then the same with – so we did Korean fried chicken, and that one was where the dry brine came into play, because you don't really batter that one so much. So we were tossing that one in baking powder and salt, and the baking powder raises the pH level of the chicken, or like the meat anyways, the skin, and then it breaks down the proteins and kind of starts to convert them into sugar, so when you fry it, it gets extra crispy. And
got a little bit of that kind of
kind of glassy texture on the outside. Yeah,
yeah.
So it's, you don't need a breading. You can fry it just straight as is, and it kind of makes its own crust and locks in its own juices.
Yeah, right. It's interesting when you're mentioning this, there's so much science involved in cooking. And especially, it seems like maybe I'm wrong about this, but especially when all the different things you do with meats.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a lot, there's a lot really happening on the kind of scientific end.
Yeah. I mean, that's – if you know a recipe, you know kind of how to do something. But if you know kind of the science, which is really when you boil all the cooking down, it's what you're doing is weird kind of
– you're converting it
you're
into –
you're doing a science project.
Yeah, right.
So if you know the science, then you know the why of what you're doing. And then from there, you can kind of do whatever you want. You can take things in different directions or – so you're not relying so much on a set recipe. You just have more of a technique.
So if you were to tell people, okay, here's for Southern Fried Chicken, here's the steps. You know, if you want to do that this weekend, here's some recommended steps I would say to do. What would it be? What would be the 1, 2, 3, 4?
Like if I was just doing it at home and I wanted to keep things simple and not make a huge mess, I would make a brine out of my buttermilk. So just taking buttermilk, adding some kind of salt and whatever spices and flavors you want into it.
Is there a ratio there as far as the salt goes? I mean,
like maybe if you were doing maybe 2 quarts, you know, the half gallon jug mm-hmm. of buttermilk, maybe just throwing like a tablespoon of salt in there.
Okay, so really, not very much. Yeah.
No, you don't need a lot.
And there's already sodium and that kind of thing in the buttermilk, right?
I mean, it's got its own it's like a high acid content, so it's already going to kind of be doing the own thing with breaking down the meat and everything.
Gotcha. Okay.
Tenderizing the proteins.
So then do you kind of soak it overnight? Is that what you refrigerate
it? Soak it? At least 4 hours.
Okay.
And then I would have my dredge ready with all the same spices in that and just kind of do this, you know, flour back in the buttermilk and then back in the flour. And then you can just fry it on the stovetop. I mean, you don't need to really set up unless you got like a deep fryer.
When you're frying it on the stovetop, though, how much oil in a pan? Are you really covering it or are you?
Just like maybe a quarter to half an inch. Okay. I like it to only go like halfway up the chicken.
Okay.
And so then like I just keep flipping it. As soon as the crust sets, then you flip it.
All right.
But or if you have a little deep fryer, you know, a little fry daddy that you could get it from like Fred Meyer. I only fry it at 325 because if you do it any higher, then the outside, like the flour is going to burn before the actual chicken cooks.
So what are some hints on when the chicken's done? How do you know?
I mean, one is like when it starts to float, it's a good sign that it's getting close. But really chicken or really cooking any meat for that matter, thermometers. Really the
best. And 165, is that what you're looking for or a little bit lower? Or?
You can honestly do 155. 165 is where it's like guaranteed to have killed any pathogens instantly. But the whole temperature thing is also like it has an inverse relationship with time. So if you have it at 155 and it's held there for a little while, that's also going to kill you. I mean, technically, if you held your chicken at 135 degrees for 30 minutes, it would be pasteurized. But I don't know if anyone wants to eat like medium rare chicken.
No.
You know?
No.
I think it'd be a little unsettling. So the whole 165 thing is a safeguard if you're, you know, then you're guaranteed to have killed everything. But, you know, pulling it at 155 when you're at home is not the end of the world.
Can I ask you about another thing, which is this actually just came up. I was talking to someone about it just this week. Aged meats. Have you done any of that kind of stuff where you're aging either steaks or – I know you've done a lot of stuff where you're making cured meats and you're making all these amazing sausages and things like that. So that's an interesting thing I'd love to talk to you about too. But aging meats, is that something you've done? And what is it – and when we're talking about the science, like what's the science behind that? How can you just age a hunk of meat and that it's – and that's still safe to eat?
I mean it has to be done at a – in a safe and like a controlled environment. But at the same time, I mean, technically you could do it in your fridge. The real big thing when they're doing it like commercially or, you know, nice steakhouses is they control their humidity. Your fridge is probably going to run at like 45% humidity, 40%. And a steakhouse where they're dry aging, they're probably going to do it closer to like 75 or 80.
So it's really a drying process, the aging process.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so they're drying it to – it's causing the water, you know, it's like 85% water. You're trying to lose that extra water weight. And as the water kind of goes out, it's concentrating its beefy flavors. It's tenderizing the meat as it ages. And then also there's like different amino acids that kind of start to come into play, which are what a lot of flavor is built on. But aging meat is how, you know, that kind of was the standard for the meat industry, you know, back before they had refrigeration and cryovacking and all this kind of stuff was all your meat was basically aged. You went to a butcher shop and they'd been hanging a side of beef for 21 days or longer.
Yeah, that's true. That's the old – even like when you think about how a butcher shop was portrayed like in old drawings or even black and white film or whatever, it was always these meats just hanging in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So it – you know,
and that was about they were keeping it dry and kind of maybe just some air circulating or something like that?
Yeah, you have to
have
air circulation.
Okay, yeah.
And there's different things that you have to worry about. Like there's a thing called case hardening, and case hardening is where the outside of the meat hardens. And so the moisture is trapped inside. And so instead of dry aging, you're basically just rotting your meat. Yeah. And like if ultraviolet light, which is, you know, like the light you have in your refrigerator.
Oh, sure.
That breaks down fats and causes them to go rancid. So there's a lot of different
variables
that go into it that you really need to know what you're looking at. And then you have to trim it all off.
And it seemed like, especially when you're starting your Italian restaurant, and I'm always, is it Boca? In Boca al Lupo.
Yeah.
Yes, I always
we
get
all
that
just call
kind
it
of
Lupo. I don't know.
Lupo. Yeah. I always call it Boca. I just call it mouth.
Mouth. It works.
But I know that, like, when you were starting that, and as I've gone there, a real hallmark of a lot of what you serve is the sausages and, you know, those kinds of things that you prepare on site and age and do on site.
Yeah.
And why is that something that you felt like was really a key part of what you wanted to present?
Well, it's always something that's kind of really interested me. I mean, like 4 years ago, I went and hung out with a family in Calabria, and we spent 2 weeks kind of breaking down the pigs and making salami and stuff. So it's where I learned it. But I mean, in a sense, like the technology, you now have like temperature controls and humidity and all this kind of stuff. But the real kind of science and process of it hasn't changed for like 2,000 years since the Romans were doing it, you know, salting meat and hanging it in a cave.
Just as a way of preserving it and also flavoring it.
Yeah,
yeah, right,
exactly.
Right.
So, I mean, that's like in Calabria, they, you know, every January they're slaughtering a pig and then they're using the fresh cuts right away and the rest they're preserving and they eat it throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's just something that's a long-time tradition. Speaking of that, the other thing I wanted to ask you about as we're heading here now, we're kind of getting out of fall. Is this a particular harvest time that people should be thinking about as far as foraging and that kind of thing? Are there things that people can be looking for? Is it a little past that or?
You know, I kind of think it's a little past that.
Yeah.
Foraging in particular is kind of hyper-seasonal, so you kind of have these real brief windows of time into doing it. But that being said, I mean, there's – as far as like harvesting going, there's a lot of really cool local growers now. I mean, a lot of them are doing like indoor like hydroponic kind of things.
Sure.
But Panhandle Produce carries a lot of really cool stuff. And Juno Greens, which supplies all of our like arugula and basil that we're doing at the Lupo.
So there's this outlet now for people to get fresh, locally grown.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't exist.
Cool stuff, yeah.
Even
right.
A year ago. So it's really kind of changing what we have access to here.
Yeah, how has that changed how you're like the menus you're presenting?
Well, before, like basil, you know, we used to just get garbage basil, even paying to fly it up so it was as fresh as we could get.
Just didn't have the flavor. Just
no,
yeah.
And now we're clipping it straight off the plant. They're bringing us fresh, you know, hydroponic, like still living
alive
basil.
Yeah.
And that's kind of changed a lot as far as flavor and everything.
Right, yeah.
And their arugula is crazy, you know.
And are they also doing the, what do they call, like the micro sprouts or the sprout, that kind of?
So Panhandle Produce is doing the sprouts.
Okay.
And then Juno Greens does a lot of the lettuces and stuff. But,
and what is that sprouts thing? Someone was describing that to me, that it's unlike what I think of when I think of sprouts, because they're sprouting different seeds that have really intense flavor components, right?
Yeah. So it's the plant itself. It's just they're harvesting as soon as it kind of starts to poke out of the soil, but it's kind of like a concentrated little pop of flavor. So they're doing like mustard greens and basil. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And they have little mixes and their pea shoots are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. Well, Bo, thanks so much for coming in. The part of what we do here on Foodie Friday is we challenge people to take on, let's name it the buttermilk. Let's say that's the one we're going to ask people to do. So if you're challenged by Bo's description of how to at home prepare that buttermilk brine, a little bit of salt and some buttermilk, soak it overnight at least 4 hours, and then double dredge it.
Double dredge,
and just regular flour?
Yeah, well, all-purpose or low-gluten flour, whatever you have, is kind of give you a more tender crust.
All right, sounds good. And let's see those photographs, folks. And just about a half inch of oil or so, you can just do it on your stovetop.
Yep.
Watch the temperature, right? Don't let it get too
hot.
Yeah,
you don't want to let it get too hot.
On the stovetop, keep it kind of just enough so that it's sizzling.
And don't start a grease fire.
And don't start a grease fire.
Yeah.
Please no grease
fire.
That's
the key.
Bo, thanks so much for coming in, man. Appreciate it. And thanks so much for letting us know some of your secrets behind amazing fried chicken.
Yeah.
Bo runs Al Boca de...
In Boca.
In Boca Al Lupo.
Al Lupo.
All right. Delicious Italian fare restaurant. What kind of... Would you say that's... Is it Napolese? Is it...
We started as Calabrian, like Southern Italian, but I don't think people were really getting it. So we're just kind of all over the place now.
Yeah. And it's got an amazing wood-fired oven. It's got incredible pizzas and other fantastic stuff that you do every single night there. Thanks, Bo.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming in, man.